Genesis 6:9 through 8:22, the ninth talk in a series in Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on October 1, 2000 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2000. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed, in whole, for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Last time I taught about the first section of Genesis chapter 6. I'm working through Genesis, slowly. And let me just summarize where we left off in Genesis, and then I'm going to retell the story of the flood. My interpretation of the first part of chapter 6 does not correspond well with the commentaries that I've consulted, so I offer it for what it's worth, but I think this makes the most sense in the context, and that's why I'm taking it this way. Let me just read very quickly the first few verses of chapter 6, and then I won't go into great detail on this because I already talked about it, but I will do it briefly. Now it came about when men began to multiply on the face of the land, and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful. And they took wives for themselves, whomever they chose. Then the Lord said, My spirit shall not strive with man forever, because he also is flesh. Nevertheless, his days shall be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came in to the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. Those were the mighty men who were old, who were of old men of renown. Up to now in Genesis, what we've seen is that God created the heavens and the earth, and he placed man in it, and placed him in it for a purpose, gave him one constraint, and that was that he was not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Man ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. He disobeyed what God had told him to do. He became a rebel. As a result of that, life changed for man. And what God did in response to man's rebellion was to say, I made you with certain God-given desires. You have decided that you are a God in the sense that you can decide what is right and what is wrong, what you will do and what you will not do. But you were not made to be a God. And as a result, I am going to face you into the fact that you are a creature and not the creator. You were made with God-given desires. Now as you go out to try to fulfill those desires, I guarantee you will fail. You were made with these desires, basic desires. And God is saying essentially, I dare you to gain fulfillment of those desires. Because I am going to guarantee that in independence from me, you will fail to satisfy those desires. As a result, then, man is plunged into this world of futility. That apart from God, everything turns to rust in our hands. Everything disintegrates. Relationships fall apart. We experience a kind of death. Death in the most significant sense of the term. It's not life as it was intended to be lived. Right after Adam and Eve had sinned, became rebels in the garden, the next account we have is of Cain, a son of Adam and Eve. And Cain, out of jealousy, and for no good reason, killed his brother Abel. So we see in the next generation, we see the extent of this kind of rebelliousness, how wicked it really is, how outrageous it is, and how foolish it is. God came to Cain after he had killed Abel, and Cain's response was one of arrogance and rebelliousness, even though he was confronted with his own sinfulness. And as we read on in the account, it describes the descendants of Cain, and they are characterized by wickedness, lawlessness, and arrogance. But God had born to Adam and Eve another son who was appointed in the place of Abel, and that was Seth. Seth means appointed. I would just point out, our son Seth was also appointed. We had decided upon the name before he was born, before that we knew that he had Down syndrome, and the name has become increasingly appropriate as time goes on. Seth was given to us to teach us a lot of things. But Seth was appointed to take the place of Abel. And the descendants of Seth, to the extent that we have descriptions of them, they are godly. So we have two lines of descent, one characterized by wickedness, the other one characterized by obedience to God. So what happened over time? Why is it that things came to such a pass that God was going to destroy all of mankind? And I think that that's what the first part of chapter 6 is telling us. When it says the sons of God, I think it is referring to those who basically the descendants of Seth, that is, those who were inclined towards righteousness. But they saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves, whomever they chose. What's happening is they are deciding who they will become one with on the basis of physical attraction. Now, that may seem trivial, but all of our actions, one way or another, betray what we value. Our words are not a very good indication of what we value. We say all kinds of things. If you want to know what someone really values, watch them. See what they do. And in this case, the sons of God chose life partners, people with whom they would become one, on the basis of physical attraction. In other words, their values have been corrupted. Because physical attraction, it's not nothing, but on the scale of important things, it's way down there. There are things that are far more important, and those have faded from their vision. So he says, my spirit will not strive with man forever because he is also flesh. Nevertheless, his days shall be 120 years. I think what God is saying here is, if you look at the genealogies, the people prior to this time were living very long lives. Lives in the several hundreds of years, up to 1,000 years. Someone who lives 1,000 years, think about their perspective on life and death. Think about your life. When did you reach the point where you realized you're going to die, if you've reached that point? I mean, for most of us, certainly for most of our lives, death is not a reality. It's this distant thing that happens to other people. But we don't think of it as something that is right around the corner for us. It isn't something that forces us to be sober-minded about life. Just think if you were to live 900 years, if the normal life expectancy were 900 years or 1,000 years, when would you get serious about life? When would you face into your own mortality? It'd be a long time. So I think what God is doing here is he's saying, I am going to shorten man's lifespan and face him into his own mortality much sooner than has happened in the past. Verse 5, then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. That's fairly emphatic. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. And the Lord said, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land, from man to animals to creeping things and to birds of the sky, for I am sorry that I have made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. So God has decided he is going to wipe out mankind because of his wickedness. So that's the reason for the flood. Okay, so that's where I'm going to pick up in verse 9. And this account goes for about 3 chapters. I am actually going to read through the whole thing. It is long. It is somewhat repetitive. And I do not know the reasons for the repetitiveness. However, it occupies a fairly large section of Genesis. I think it's intended to attract our attention. So I will read through section by section and then give comments after each section. I'm going to read it in about 4 different sections. But I want to read it because I'm convinced that ultimately, Moses is a better storyteller than I am. Genesis 6, 9 through 22. These are the records of the generations of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his time. Noah walked with God, and Noah became the father of 3 sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now the earth was corrupt in the sight of God, and the earth was filled with violence. And God looked on the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way upon the earth. Then God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence because of them. And behold, I am about to destroy them with the earth. Make for yourself an ark of gopher wood. You shall make the ark with rooms, and shall cover it inside and out with pitch. And this is how you shall make it. The length of the ark, 300 cubits, its breadth, 50 cubits, its height, 30 cubits. You shall make a window for the ark, and finish it to a cubit from the top, and set the door of the ark in the side of it. You shall make it with lower, second, and third decks. And behold, I am bringing the flood of water upon the earth to destroy all flesh in which is the breath of life from under heaven. Everything that is on the earth shall perish, but I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall enter the ark, you and your sons and your wife and your sons' wives with you. And of every living thing of all flesh, you shall bring 2 of every kind into the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female. Of the birds after their kind and of the animals after their kind, of every creeping thing of the ground after its kind, 2 of every kind shall come to you to keep them alive. And as for you, take for yourself some of all food which is edible, and gather it to yourself, and it shall be for food for you and for them. Thus Noah did according to all that God had commanded him, so he did. So God, in response to this fact, that all of mankind has turned rebellious. The earth was corrupt in the sight of God, and it was filled with violence, outrageous injustice. And in light of this fact, God has decided he is going to wipe out all living things on earth, on the dry land, apparently. Later it says he's going to destroy the earth itself. So he tells Noah to build an ark. Now the ark, it's apparently just a wooden box. It didn't have to be streamlined. It wasn't necessarily going anywhere. It just had to float. But it's a big box. The dimensions here, a cubit is about 18 inches, depending on which kind of cubit, but the standard cubit is about 18 inches. So this box is about the size of think of a football field, including the end zones, and the sidelines going out to include the benches on both sides. That's about the size of the footprint of this box. And then it's three layers high. So this is a big box. It's got a roof on it, and then there is a window, an opening that goes apparently around the top, between the window and the top floor or something, that allows fresh air in, presumably. And there's a door in it. Noah was to build this thing and then cover it with tar, both on the inside and the outside. That must have been an amazing project. For all we know, there's only Noah and presumably his three sons are working on this project. There's no reason to believe that anyone else is working on this because it's an absolutely crazy thing to be doing. But that's a lot of wood that has to be cut, trees cut down and then milled, presumably. I mean, I don't know what it looked like. I don't know how finely milled it was, but presumably milled to some one degree or another. It had to hold together in water, so it had to be fairly well built. We've got three floors. It had to be fairly substantial beams that are extending over fairly substantial distances. I mean, I wouldn't want to do such a project. That's huge. If my interpretation is correct, there's no indication how long this took him to build, but it had to have been an extended period of time. I would think years. Because not only does he have to build the ark, he has to care for himself and his family along the way. So building the ark is his moonlighting, presumably. Living is the other job. It must have been quite a sight for anyone who came along and saw it to see. We don't know where he built it, but presumably he built it on land. And if he built it on land, how would anyone think that they could get that from the land to the water? It must have been an absolutely crazy thing to see. We don't know how many people saw it, but whoever saw it, they must have just said, presumably they asked Noah, what are you doing? And presumably, Noah would have told them. I firmly believe that if God came to Noah and told him, I'm going to destroy all of the earth because of its wickedness, that Noah would have made that known to people. That a judgment is coming. So presumably anybody who came would have asked Noah what's going on, and he would have told them what's going on. And their response would have been, you're crazy. I find that intriguing because from time to time, when I'm thinking about God, this God that made everything, is behind everything that happens, who has worked out this scheme of history in which he picks up a people and makes them into a nation. And despite their unfaithfulness towards him, he is faithful towards them. And he becomes man, lives among us, and is put to death by us, rises from the dead, so that we can have salvation. It sounds crazy. I mean, there are times when I'm thinking about it and it sounds absolutely crazy. And that God made us to be righteous beings, when very few people are interested in righteousness, and there's a sense in which they seem to be doing fine. There's a sense in which that's true. And sometimes I think about all that stuff and I think, it's crazy. But every time I have those thoughts, I kind of draw back and I say, but who's crazy? I mean, who understands reality as it actually is? Because as I look more closely, people who are not devoted to righteousness, their lives are not doing well. When I look at the people around me, who is it that can cope with adversity in their lives? I mean, none of us do it very gracefully. But there are some people that seem to be able to weather such things, and there are other people whose lives just go into a tailspin as a consequence of it. I mean, look around and whose lives are falling apart and whose lives are not. It seems to me that it's the realistic ones, it's the ones who understand life the way it really is, that are going to be in the best position to be able to cope with life as it really is. And so it's the question of who's crazy. And I'm quite confident that as I look at things more soberly and more carefully, that the description of life that we have in the Bible is the one that really stands up to the tests of time. The one that really is able to help us to cope with reality as it comes. Okay, first chapter 7. Then the Lord said to Noah, "Enter the ark, you and all your household, for you alone I have seen to be righteous before me in this time. You shall take with you of every clean animal by sevens, a male and his female, and of the animals that are not clean, two, a male and his female. Also of the birds of the sky by sevens, male and female, to keep offspring alive on the face of the earth. For after 7 more days I will send rain on the earth, 40 days and 40 nights, and I will blot out from the face of the land every living thing that I have made." And Noah did according to all that the Lord had commanded him. Now Noah was 600 years old when the flood of water came upon the earth. Then Noah and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him entered the ark because of the water of the flood. Of clean animals and animals that are not clean and birds and everything that creeps on the ground, there went into the ark to Noah by twos, male and female, as God had commanded Noah. And it came about after the 7 days that the water of the flood came upon the earth. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the 2nd month, on the 17th day of the month, On the same day, all the fountains of the great deep burst open, and the floodgates of the sky were opened, and the rain fell upon the earth for 40 days and 40 nights. Here it's a little bit more specific as to how many animals will be in the ark. Before it said two of every kind. Here it makes it more specific and says, as a general rule, it will be two of a kind, but there will be seven of every clean animal and of every bird. Now, the clean animals, presumably such a notion developed even before the law was given. I don't know if the concept of clean animals here corresponds exactly to the definition of clean animals that we have later in the law, but presumably the notion developed even before the law was given. Interestingly, that's not the only concept that we see in the law that was developed before the law was given. We noticed with Cain and Abel that they gave offerings, and yet no law, there's no mention of any law having been given. After the flood, Noah is going to give a sacrifice on an altar. And yet there's no indication that a law was given for those things. So there seems to be a religious impulse in man. And these are the vehicles that man chose in ancient times to express that religious impulse. And later on, those things were incorporated into the law that was given through Moses. It makes sense that there would be more clean animals and more birds because they are going to be the first that will die. In fact, Noah, right after he gets off the ark, gives an offering of animals. So presumably those are the animals that they needed more of right from the beginning. Now, we have a fairly precise chronology given here. The flood begins in Noah's 600th year, the 600th year of his life, in the second month of that year, on the 17th day of that year. So we have a very precise chronology that we're working from here. And they went into the ark. They were there for 7 days before anything started to happen. That must have been a strange 7 days. And if I were Noah, there would have been a lot of second guessing. Is this going to happen? Did we do the right thing? Was this worth it? But at the end of those 6 days then, the rain starts, and it says the fountains of the great deep burst open. So there's water coming down and there's water coming up that generates all of the water on the earth that floods it. Okay, verse 13. On the very same day, Noah and Shem and Ham and Japheth, the sons of Noah, and Noah's wife and the three wives of his sons were with them, entered the ark. They and every beast after its kind, and all the cattle after their kind, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth after its kind, and every bird after its kind, all sorts of birds. So they went into the ark to Noah, by twos of all flesh in which was the breath of life. And those that entered, male and female of all flesh, entered as God had commanded him. And the Lord closed it behind him. Then the flood came upon the earth for 40 days. And the water increased and lifted up the ark so that it rose above the earth. And the water prevailed and increased greatly upon the earth. And the ark floated on the surface of the water. And the water prevailed more and more upon the earth so that all the high mountains everywhere under the heavens were covered. The water prevailed 15 cubits higher, and the mountains were covered. And all flesh that moved on the earth perished. Birds and cattle and beasts and every swarming thing that swarms upon the earth and all mankind. Of all that was on the dry land, all in whose nostrils was the breath of the spirit of life died. Thus he blotted out every living thing that was upon the face of the land, from man to animals to creeping things and to birds of the sky, and they were blotted out from the earth. And only Noah was left, together with those that were with him in the ark. And the water prevailed upon the earth 150 days. So for 40 days and 40 nights, water's coming down and coming up. And so the level of water on the earth keeps rising. It rises to the point where it is at the top of the mountains, and then 15 cubits higher. Now, presumably, it makes sense that the ark must have had a draft of about 15 cubits. And that's how they know the depth of the water, that it was at least 15 cubits above the peaks over which the ark had passed. Now, the ark was located, according to the account, in the area of Mount Ararat. Mount Ararat is in the mountains of Armenia, if we've got the right Mount Ararat. And Mount Ararat, there are actually two peaks there. There's the lesser and the greater. The greater is about 16,000 feet. The lesser, I think, is about 12,000 feet. So the ark probably then was lifted up 15 cubits higher than Mount Ararat. Did the water go higher than that? I don't know. Would it be contrary to the language we have in this account that Mount Everest was not covered with water? Probably not. That it's possible that it was just higher than Mount Ararat by 15 cubits or more, so it just went up 16,000 feet. Did it have to go up the extra, what's Mount Everest, 29, go up that high? I don't know that the account demands that. Let me say just a few words about that particular issue. We need to realize that language has a great deal of flexibility and grant that flexibility to the authors. When we use terms like all and everything and everybody, we don't always mean all and everything and everybody. That we can use the term all and not mean each and every. All has that kind of flexibility. Same with everybody and everything. Let's just a common everyday example. I can say that there was a party the other night and everybody was there. We all know what that means. It does not mean that every single human being was there. We know that. So just because it says all, it doesn't mean each and every. Language has that kind of flexibility. Now, it says that all of life was destroyed from the face of the earth. All, every man, every beast. And it says that emphatically in several different places here. I think that in that case, the language demands that it was in fact all. In particular, every human being. I think that the author intends us to understand that every human being, for sure, except for the eight that were in the ark, were killed. But when it says that the whole earth was covered with water, is he really insisting that every square inch of the earth was covered with water? I don't think that the language demands that. Furthermore, when it says all of the animals came into the ark, does it demand that every single species was represented in the ark? I don't think that it demands that. It could very well be that the evidence that they have found with respect to dinosaurs and their sudden disappearance, it could be that the flood would account for that. and that those species were not brought to Noah and put on the ark. I'm just speculating, but it seems to me that that's plausible. But I'm just pointing out that language has a lot of flexibility, and all does not necessarily mean each and every. So, water, the water rises to a point of 15 cubits above the highest peak, and it's there for 150 days, half a year. Okay, chapter 8. But God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the cattle that were with him in the ark. And God caused a wind to pass over the earth, and the waters subsided. Also the fountains of the deep and the floodgates of the sky were closed, and the rain from the sky was restrained, and the water receded steadily from the earth. And at the end of 150 days, the water decreased. And in the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, the ark rested on the mountains of Ararat. And the water decreased steadily until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the first day of the month, the tops of the mountains became visible. Then it came about at the end of 40 days that Noah opened the window of the ark which he had made. And he sent out a raven, and it flew here and there until the water was dried up from the earth. Then he sent out a dove from him to see if the water was abated from the face of the land. But the dove found no resting place for the sole of her foot. So she returned to him in the ark, for the water was on the surface of all the earth. Then he put out his hand and took her and brought her into the ark to himself. So he waited yet another 7 days. And again he sent out the dove from the ark. And the dove came to him toward evening. And behold, in her beak was a freshly picked olive leaf. So Noah knew that the water was abated from the earth. Then he waited yet another 7 days and sent out the dove, but she did not return to him again. Now it came about in the 601st year, in the first month, on the first of the month, the water was dried up from the earth. Then Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked, and behold, the surface of the ground was dried up. And in the second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth was dry. Then God spoke to Noah, saying, "Go out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons' wives with you. Bring out with you every living thing of all flesh that is with you, birds and animals and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, that they may breed abundantly on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth." So Noah went out, and his sons and his wives and his sons' wives with him. Every beast, every creeping thing, and every bird, everything that moves on the earth, went out by their families from the ark. So, after the 150 days of the water being at its height, God begins to move and act to reverse the destruction that has taken place. And the water, the rain has stopped, and the water is no longer coming from below, and so the water is going down, it's receding. And in the seventh month then, on the 17th day, the ark rests on the mountaintop. So again, we have a fairly precise chronology here. It's been 7 months. Well, not quite. It's been 5 months. Since the flood started. Then the water keeps going down further, and on the 10th month, on the first day of that month, they can see the tops of the surrounding peaks, apparently. Then, after another 40 days, Noah lets a raven go. I don't know much about ravens, I don't know much about birds, but apparently, what the commentaries say about ravens is that they don't mind the wet and they are quite happy to live on carcasses. So presumably the raven went out and was happy. The raven was able to live. It was dry enough, at least, for the raven to survive. He let a dove go, and the dove was not quite so happy with conditions outside, and the dove came back. 7 days later, he let the dove go again. This time it leaves, and it comes back with an olive leaf. Olives, apparently, olive trees, can live underwater for a period of time. They still have vitality underwater for a period of time. So at least the water is down to a level where olive trees are growing and they're close to the surface of the water. It's interesting that it would be an olive tree because the olive tree has come to symbolize over much of the earth, the olive tree has come to symbolize peace. And in fact, archaeologists, when they are doing digs, if they find olive orchards, signs of ancient olive orchards, that's very significant. The reason that's significant is because between the time that you plant an olive tree and you get your first harvest, it's between 25 and 30 years. So if you're a farmer, under what conditions would you plant an olive orchard? Only if you think things look pretty stable and peaceful for a long time. If things are precarious, you are not going to plant olive trees because you will never get anything from your labor. So whenever they find ancient olive orchards, that's a significant thing to archaeologists because it means that people's perspective was things are stable and are likely to remain stable for an extended period of time. In other words, things are peaceful. So the olive tree has come to symbolize peace all over the ancient world, as far as I know. And here there's a sense in which it's symbolizing peace as well. He waits another 7 days, lets the dove go, and this time it stays. So, after they have been in the ark for just over a year, Noah removes the covering of the ark, and they see that the ground is dry, and God tells them to go out. That must have been a long year. Okay, all of the animals go out. Verse 20 then. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord and took of every clean animal and of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And the Lord smelled the soothing aroma. And the Lord said to himself, I will never again curse the ground on account of man, for the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth. And I will never again destroy every living thing as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, and cold and heat, and summer and winter, and day and night shall not cease. So Noah's first action after he gets out of the ark is he builds an altar. That is unprecedented. This is the first use of this word altar in the Old Testament. This is the first, to our knowledge, is the first time that that happens. He builds an altar, and then he sacrifices one of each of the clean animals on that altar. Again, this is the first time that sacrifices are mentioned in the Old Testament. God's response, he says, I will never again curse the ground on account of man, for the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth. That is very strange, because as if you will recall, the reason for the flood was because every intention of man's heart was evil continually. So the destruction, the judgment, was because of man's evil. Now, he says, I will never again curse the ground on account of man, for the intent of man's heart is evil. What we have here is a change in strategy on God's part. That he had decided before the flood that he was going to judge the evil of man by wiping them out. Now, after the flood, he's indicating that his strategy is going to be different. We are not going to see that kind of universal judgment on the earth. Not for the rest of history. That kind of judgment will be at the end of history. But for the rest of history, we will not see a similar kind of judgment. As a result, then, he gives this promise to Noah, verse 22, while the earth remains, seed time and harvest, and cold and heat, and summer and winter, and day and night shall not cease. In other words, there will not be a cataclysmic environment-changing event again on the face of the earth. Because there are two ways that one could look at the absence of such a judgment. One would be to say that it shows the patience of God. God is being very patient and forbearing with the wickedness of man. The other way that one could look at it is to say, there is no God, or that if there is no God, he does not judge wickedness. Look at what it says in 2 Peter 3:3 and following. Peter says, know this first of all, that in the last days mockers will come with their mocking, following after their own lusts, and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For ever since the fathers fell asleep, all continues just as it was from the beginning of creation. For when they maintain this, it escapes their notice, that by the word of God the heavens existed long ago, and the earth was formed out of water, and by water, through which the world at that time was destroyed, being flooded with water. But the present heavens and earth, by his word, are being reserved for fire, kept for the day of judgment and destruction of ungodly men. But do not let this one fact escape your notice, beloved, that with the Lord one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day. The Lord is not slow about his promise, as some count slowness, but is patient toward you, not wishing for any to perish, but for all to come to repentance. But the day of the Lord will come like a thief, in which the heavens will pass away with a roar, and the elements will be destroyed with intense heat, and the earth and its works will be burned up. Since all these things are to be destroyed in this way, what sort of people ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, on account of which the heavens will be destroyed by burning and the elements will melt with intense heat? But according to his promise, we are looking for a new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. What Peter is pointing out here is the fact that there has not been a cataclysmic event in the natural world as a judgment of man does not mean there is no God. And it does not mean that God does not care about righteousness. What it means is God is patient. And he is patient because he is waiting and hoping that we will respond in repentance. That's why there hasn't been another flood. Not because God doesn't care, and not because what we do is not wicked. And Peter says, since all these things are to be destroyed in this way, what sort of people ought you to be in holy conduct and goodness? It's an interesting thing to think about. I don't know how many people were on the earth at the time of Noah. We don't really have a good way of estimating how many people there were. But presumably there were a large number of people. And in spite of the fact that there were a large number of people, there is only one that is explicitly stated as being righteous. We don't know about Noah's wife. We don't know about Noah's sons. It doesn't say whether they were righteous or not. They were, however, saved. So at a time when there must have been thousands of people on the earth at least, if not more than that, only eight are spared due to the righteousness of Noah. That's sobering because the proportions aren't real favorable. Though when it comes down to it, the way really is narrow. And there really will be few that enter into the kingdom. There are a lot of places that we could look at in the New Testament where the apostles exhorted their readers to, in view of the fact that it is hard to hold to this narrow way, that we need God's help and we need the help of one another in order that any of us might qualify for the kingdom. But let me read from 1 Thessalonians 5, verses 14 through 22. This is what Paul wrote. And we urge you, brethren, admonish the unruly, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak, be patient with all men, see that no one repays another with evil for evil, but always seeks after that which is good for one another and for all men. Rejoice always, pray without ceasing, in everything give thanks, for this is God's will for you in Christ Jesus. Do not quench the spirit. Do not despise prophetic utterances, but examine everything carefully. Hold fast to that which is good. Abstain from every form of evil. That's just one section in the New Testament where you can see exhortations to the readers to pursue righteousness. But it's a matter of doing two things. One is getting our own house in order. That is, are we ourselves pursuing righteousness? That's not an easy thing to do. That's a difficult thing to do. And yet that is what we are. If we really love what God loves, then we will pursue righteousness. But we are not just to keep our own house in order. It's also a matter of paying attention to those around us and helping them also to hold to the straight and narrow. It's a community project, really. It is by the mercy of God and by the help of one another that we pursue righteousness right to the end and keep the faith. Let me just go on and read the prayer that he offers right after that, and And I think that we will end with this prayer. And by the way, if you have questions, remember them next week. I will leave more time for questions next week. There probably are questions, but let's save those for next week. This is the prayer that Paul uses in 1 Thessalonians, just after the section that I just read. Now may the God of peace himself sanctify you entirely, and may your spirit and soul and body be preserved complete without blame at the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. Faithful is he who calls you, and he also will bring it to pass. Amen.